accession number 13718, reel 2.
Gone solo on the Codron G3, I had to put in so many hours of flying on this machine, and part of the training was to fly cross country and navigate from the airfield and complete certain triangular courses, which are fairly easily demarked in that part by going from one town to the other. So we used to fly north up to Chateau d'Ur and then come down to Blois, and down the River Loire, either to Tours or Orléans. And on these occasions, one flew triangles, these triangular courses, bearing in mind that one had to go a certain way round so as not to interfere with any other aircraft that might be doing the same thing. So we did probably either right-hand circuits or left-hand circuits, which were designated each day, so that nobody was in any doubt as to which way they had to turn the aircraft once they had taken off. I remember one occasion going a large triangle down to Orléans, down the river to Tours, and I thought I would try and see how high the Codron G3 would go. So I kept on climbing and climbing until I got to 9,000 feet. When I found I could get no higher, it was starting to stall. So I had to keep at that level for a short while, but not for very long, because being 1,000 feet on a very fine morning and looking around, it was really amazing to see the extent that you could bring within your compass from that height. It seemed to me that the horizon was about 50 miles away in all directions, and I could see to the horizon in each way I turned. The strange situation seemed to be that there I was suspended in midair in the center of a huge saucer, because the horizons 50 miles away seemed to be on the same level as I was, and looking down, there was this what seemed to me to be very great height with very small buildings down below at the bottom of the saucer. It was very interesting coming down the River Loire and going over the large town of Tours, which looked very handsome below, the river curving through it and various bridges at different intervals. However, at that height, I was very cold because I was in an open nacelle, and I expect the temperature was pretty well down to freezing point. So I very quickly decided to come lower in order to warm up a bit. This I mention because it was a very interesting situation to find oneself in, right up there in the sky with such a huge vista below. Now, having completed the requisite number of hours on the Codron G3, I was sent over to the other side of the station to learn to fly Curtiss J4 biplanes. These were of the conventional type with ailerons, no warped controls. It was a larger aircraft. It had a bigger engine. I think it was 150 horsepower water-cooled 8-cylinder. I was taken, first of all, dual control in order to feel the controls of the plane, and I found out that due to some peculiar torque from the engine and the rigging of the machine itself, one had to open up, and before the tail rose with sufficient forward speed, the rudder had to be put on hard left. As soon as the tail came up, and you started to run at a bigger speed across the grass before taking off, the rudder had to be readjusted again, and with a little bit of right-hand rudder, until you became airborne, and thereafter the rudder bar was put in the normal neutral position, neither left nor right. This is a very strange thing to have to get used to, but it seemed to work. This is a heavier machine than the Cobra G3 and had a wheel control which turned the ailerons up or down in order to bank the aircraft to turn. I didn't like it very much because whilst when you were airborne, it seemed to be very nice to fly. It was very much heavier under control than the Codron. And, of course, this is understandable because it was a bigger aircraft and a very much heavier one, requiring bigger power to get it off the ground and to keep it airborne. However, after the requisite number of hours, and I was only on dual for a very short time because I was acquainted now with the average kind of movements and controls of aircraft, and one only had to get used to a different type. After the requisite number of hours flying this aircraft, I was duly passed out and given a flying certificate and pecked off home to England.
Before we leave Vendôme, can you give me an idea of life on the station, if you like? I mean, apart from your flying times, you lived in a mess, presumably. I mean, what were the social activities like?
I'll tell you. Life at Vendôme was very interesting because it was a naval air station. It was run like a ship. The parade, we had to parade twice a day on what was called the quarter deck. This was a bit of gravel outside the main building, and all of the buildings were wooden huts. So the administrative building was bigger than the others and contained the offices of the officer commanding, who was a captain RN, and the first lieutenant, who took the parades. We had a flag staff, which flew the white ensign, and everything was dealt with in naval terms. We all wore naval uniform, and it was treated just like a ship, but on dry land.
Did it have a name? HMS.
It did, I've forgotten it.
I mean, Yeovilton is called HMS Heron.
I know it is. I forgot the name of this one. Oh, dear, I better see if I got a record somewhere.
Anyhow, you dined in the wardroom, presumably.
That's right. We lived in wooden huts containing 24 beds, 12 each side, heated by a central tortoise kind of stove burning coke with a chimney going out through the roof. We were there in the winter time, and we had snow on the ground, I remember, for 3 or 4 days when no flying could be entertained at all. The mess room was a much larger hut, and the kitchens, I suppose, were adjoining. I do remember that these huts were heated with these large cylindrical, tall, tortoise stoves, I think they were called, with a chimney going out through the roof. And they used to get very hot indeed. The bread we had was baked in the villages around and brought to the station every day. These were French bread of long, wide loaves. We used to cut these across into producing long strips of bread, somewhere about 8 inches long and about 4 inches wide. We used to toast these by slapping them up against the side of the tortoise stoves, and when they were toasted and sufficiently crisp, they fell off, and one then turned the other side and produced the same result on the other side. So we had plenty of toast at that time produced in this fashion. The food, I think, must have been very basic. I can't remember what it was. We had very good appetites. I think we were reasonably well fed. And as far as I can remember, most of the food was purchased locally and came from local butchers and bakers and so forth. I remember on the few occasions when we had a bit of time off due to bad weather conditions or because of the flying procedure, we would hire bicycles and go for rides around the surrounding villages, which are very small hamlets with very tiny churches. and small estaminets where we could go in and have a drink of the local wine. It was a very sparsely populated rural area in which we were situated. The little town of Vendôme was a medieval town and had an ancient castle in it. On the occasions we went there, which was by getting a lift on a motor lorry, going in for either a short leave of a few hours or to pick up rations, and we would go to the local restaurant or estaminet in the main square. This is quite a good one, actually, and one must remember that in those days, although there was very severe rationing at home in England, living in a rural part of France, there was much more food and in fairly plentiful amounts, so that we were able to buy butter, which we hadn't heard of, and I remember going back after my tour in France and taking 2 pounds of butter home with me for my mother. Is that all right? I'm running out of steam at the moment. Going for a walk with 2 or 3 companions down the road, which is a typical French road with tall poplar trees each side, very straight, one afternoon, and meeting a French man and his wife. I suppose they must have been middle class, fairly well off people, also out for a stroll, probably living in a country house nearby. And we stopped in conversation with our halting French, carried on a conversation with these two people who seemed to be very interested in us. And I do remember that at that time, the Germans had made a big push. Don't forget that the Russian Revolution took place a little time before, just about the time I went to Greenwich, the Russian Revolution took place. The Germans made peace with the revolutionaries who gained control and were thus able to move their armies from the Eastern Front across to the Western Front. This is easy to say, and it probably took them a few months to translate so many thousands of men and equipment and so on to the Western Front. But they did, and they determined to make a big push and try and end the war that spring. So this big push took place whilst we were in France. We had occasionally information about what was going on in the world outside. In fact, I imagine we were pretty well informed, being a working naval station, with everything that was going on. And I imagine and remember that notices would be posted on the notice board as to a bit of world news or war news elsewhere. So we were aware of this big push going on whilst we were in France. And the Germans pushed within about 55 miles of Paris whilst we were there. Whilst, therefore, we met these people and were talking to them, this was the kind of situation going on all around us. And these people, this man and woman, I remember, were very dejected indeed about the situation. They thought that the Germans would keep on pushing. And I remember a rather pathetic remark they said, that we were there, we were the English being taught to fly on this naval air station, and that they thought that they hoped that the English would be able to come to their support and stop any further advance by the Germans.
A slight echo of 1940.
I remember, I'll go on now. I say that after passing out on Curtiss machines, I had completed my course at Vendôme. I now had my pilot's certificate and was given a piece of paper to say so, and was given the usual pass and sent home on leave. But with a further instruction that I would have to report in another week's time at the RNAS station at Calshot. So I had a week's leave ahead of me, and off I went with a few others by train to Paris. We left by the late afternoon train, got to Paris about dark, and had to find a hotel because we couldn't go on to England at that time until we waited for the following day. At that time, the Germans had made this big push, and we happened to arrive in Paris at the time when they were shelling it with a long-range gun that they had brought up on a railway truck, which was called Big Bertha. This is a gun with a very long barrel that had been designed and built particularly for this purpose, to fling a shell a long distance. And Paris was within distance of the range of this gun. These shells fell on Paris every half hour. The intervening time between the next one being fired was to allow the barrel of the gun to cool down sufficiently. So whilst we were in Paris, there were occasional bangs and thuds as these shells fell quite indiscriminately, and either fell in an open space or fell on houses and partially demolished them. I don't think there were very many casualties. As the shells came down almost vertically, I suppose they hit the tops of buildings before penetrating further, so people kept down below in the cellars as much as they could. Certainly the Parisians got used to this shelling very quickly, because as soon as they heard a shell explode, they would all go out and do their shopping or take the children to school or bring them back home and then wait for the next one during the next half hour. We were in Paris just for that night and came home on the following day. And I remember when we got to Calais, because we were coming back Calais this time, we couldn't take the morning boat and were told we'd have to wait for 3 or 4 hours. And the reason was that they were shipping hundreds of German prisoners of war over to England that morning. And I remember seeing these dejected lines of grey uniformed men waiting to be shipped aboard and sent over to England as prisoners.
Were you escorted in your crossing, or did you travel on an ordinary civilian boat?
I'll come to that. We crossed over with the usual cross-channel packets. As I remember, they were twin-funnel steamers, and I suppose by present-day standards, comparatively small. But when we did cross, and I remember on our initial crossing from Folkestone, which was in the morning, we were all issued with life jackets. We stayed on deck, and two cross-channel boats went in convoy, escorted by a destroyer each side, because the Straits of Dover were quite dangerous. German U-boats could penetrate, and while surface craft did not appear, it was possible at night time for surface craft to make a dash through. E-boats could make a dash through. I certainly remember on the crossing from Folkestone to Boulogne that about halfway across we changed course, and looking over on the port side as we changed course to starboard, I could see a floating mine bobbing about. So there was a considerable amount of danger, and obviously the Germans, knowing the vast amount of traffic going to and fro, it would be an obvious place for them to try and attack, although exceedingly dangerous for them as well.
Anyhow, you went on leave.
I went on leave. And then I took my marching orders and went to Calshot. That's right, I went to Calshot. I can't quite remember how I got there, but I obviously took train to Southampton and got a picket boat from there to Calshot. Anyway, Calshot was a fairly big station and also had flying boats as well as seaplanes. But it was also a training station. And I was detailed from Calshot to go to Lyon-Solent, so I crossed over to Lyon-Solent. We were put in a barrack block in Warsash, which is just the other side of the Hamble River. And from there, we would go across by picket boat to Calshot every morning and back in the evening. When I was at Leon Solent, I was quartered in a very nice residential house on the top of the cliff. Several of these had been commandeered by the Navy, and we were quartered there. I think there were a dozen of us in that one house, and probably another dozen in another house. So there was a squad of us then, all starting training on seaplanes, all at the same time. As I remember, there were very few others who had been to Vendôme. The other people had learned to fly at other stations in England. But we all got together at Leon Solent to learn to fly seaplanes. The kind of aircraft that were at Leon Solent at that time were housed on the top of the cliff and were lowered into the water every morning by a big jib crane that was also on the top of the cliff, put down on the beach and pushed out into the water, and there they were floated on the water, touching the beach, with a rating detailed for each one to hold it there as the tide went up and went down. And they were always there, ready, therefore, to take off. We started to learn to fly seaplanes on a short 150. This was a 150 horsepower engine, water-cooled, and was a biplane with flaps on the top plane, not ailerons at all. These are two big flaps at the rear end of the top plane, which, being flaps, just flapped down. They were in a vertical situation and the plane wasn't moving. When you took off, these flaps would slowly rise as the airspeed increased until they were trailing level with the top plane. And as one turned off and used the wheel control for the flaps or the ailerons, you either depressed one side or the other. This is a very strange idea, and I can never understand why, but they seem to work very well. Well, we had dual control on these seaplanes, and after a short while got used to the slightly different technique of getting off the water, which was, of course, that as your forward speed increased, because you took off with full power of the engine, the floats were so designed that as you increased the speed, the aircraft rose on the floats until at probably about 30 knots or so, you were riding across the water on the heels of the floats. As the speed increased and the weight came onto the wings, so you slowly left the water. And once you got into that situation, the aircraft was very easy to manoeuvre.
Now, these short seaplanes, they had a very high wing aspect ratio, didn't they?
Yeah.
And quite a long endurance?
I should say. Well, I'll come to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. After learning to fly on a short 150, we also had some small flying boats. These were, as I remember, called, one was called an FBA. I'm not sure where it was built, whether it was French or British, I'm not sure. But this was a small boat in which the pilot and the observer or the pupil sat side by side in an open cockpit. Behind them was a biplane, and high up between the wings was a gnome rotary engine. So this was a pusher. When the engine started, I can't quite remember how the engine was started. It was obviously started by a mechanic with a handle, because you couldn't get behind it to swing the propeller, because that is where the boat tapered out to the tail. Anyway, with the engine going and blipping it, and I'll come to that, because being a rotary engine and the cylinder spinning round, the technique of controlling the throttle was slightly different from a fixed radial engine. So we had two small levers on the throttle control, and these were adjusted in such a way that the engine was kept going, but not giving very much power. But as soon as you got launched and taxied out, you opened up the engine to its full power, turned into wind, and then took off. They were quite easy to take off, I remember. Taking off into the wind, obviously, meant going across the waves, and the short waves, even quite short waves, bumped a bit as the boat rose on the water and before it finally took off. Once you got airborne, they were quite nice to control. And one had the most magnificent view sitting in front with all the wings and the power behind and an unrestricted view of everything around. The one thing that was difficult about these flying boats, and we were warned about this by the instructor, and being taken up with dual control again, sitting side by side, the instructor made us realize that as soon as one decided to alight on the water and got in position to do so, that is, facing the wind and at the right position near the shore, one throttled back the engine and immediately put the flying boat into a fairly steep drive. The reason was that they were tail heavy once the power was released. So you had to get your angle of declination in your mind quite clear and then throttle back, not to let the engine stop. You had a button switch now to the magneto, and by pressing the button and taking the power off and the engine slowing down, one therefore was in a glide without any power assisting at all. But to stop the engine, to prevent the engine stopping, one had to release the button occasionally. So it was called blipping it down until one got into a position near the water to level out and to alight. This proved to be quite effective once one got used to the idea. One had to bear in mind that if anything went wrong with the engine suddenly, the flying boat would stall very quickly, so one had to be prepared in that event to put it into a fairly steep dive quickly in order to maintain flying speed and to prevent a stall, because a stall in a machine like that would be fatal. All right?
When you took this flying boat off, I mean, what distance was covered on the takeoff run usually? About a mile?
No. Much less. I'll go on if you like.
Actually,